Hello everybody. So we have a crisis out there, or probably multiple crises out there, and some people like Blinkfeld Kurier think it's sensible to think about some laws and everything that we consider to be given and being there, and that probably are abused by some other people. So, for example, the international humanitarian law, and that's the talk that we will have to see what it actually is and what actually it's saying. So, what are the rules? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I said before, I'm Blinkfeld Kurier, and I'm going to talk about international humanitarian law. Before I start this talk, small disclaimer, first of all, I'm not a lawyer, so everything you hear is from more or less a layman that tries to make a little bit of sense to the given laws. Also, this is not the ultimate international humanitarian law talk, because there is so much laws and texts and treatises that I'm not, I couldn't work through them all and make an talk in about an hour, and does not make everybody's heads explode. So yeah. Also, if someone sees that in the near future or so, and has maybe is a lawyer concerning the international humanitarian law, or someone from the International Committee of the Red Cross and wants to do a talk here, that would be pretty nice. And you can do better than me, maybe. So start. What is the international humanitarian law? International humanitarian law is basically a set of treaties and laws that govern how conflict should be, or the rules that apply in conflicts. It's not the rules that state what we have to do when we start a conflict or want to start a war. That's another part of international law. And basically, the laws are here to protect, on the one side, some groups of people. Depending on what treaty or text we have, the group of people varies, and we see what those groups are. Also, it protects buildings and cultural heritage and other buildings. More of that later on. And also, it restricts the means of fighting. What weapons can we use and what force can we use? And one thing I have to say is that not all laws are equal. There are ones that are considered stronger and other than actually war crimes if you break them. And then there are laws that can, to some extent, be, let's say, stretched. I'm going to look at the three big ones, I think. First of all are the Geneva Conventions. There are three of them. Then the Hague Conventions, which is more or less all the laws that had implications during history, what we can use as weapons and which means of force we can use. And I'm going to take a look at the protocols of the Geneva Convention. And yeah, so
the international humanitarian law, for the most part, is about conflicts between states or nations. In the text, they couldn't say it's all legalese. So they could not say, yeah, we have states or nations. These are always higher contracting parties. So if I mentioned higher contracting parties, please be aware, I mean nations or states. I just use the terms because I'm used to it by now. So there are other, I'm gonna take a look at these three, four treatises. There are others. First of all, there are the commentaries of the Geneva Convention. If you are a software guy and you ever implemented a language, then there's the text that says you how to implement it, and then there's the implementation itself and the commentary to that. And the commentaries of the Geneva Convention are that they told you how you should interpret it, the Geneva Convention, in order to make sense what the actual words mean. And these commentaries can be quite extensive. They go nearly word for word. They comment on everything. If the text would say that the weather is nice, they would comment in which circumstances and whatnot. The next thing that they are the Nuremberg Tribunal, because that was one of the first where they actually had to take these treatises and law and speak law. So they learned as they go, I think. And from that there were other trials and tribunals, and with every tribunal and trial we held, we learned a bit more and what makes sense and whatnot. Then there is the customary IHL, which is they made a collection of laws that and rules that apply to local customs that happen in war that are not written down, but for some reason people are following. And it's quite extensive, and I skipped it. Then there's the statutes and amendments of the International Criminal Court, because they have to speak law, so they also have their own laws and treatises who they use, and a collection of it. And then there are other conferences for certain other conventional weapons. That's quite a nice title, because it doesn't get any broader, I think. We should name that not. Maybe if we ever tired of the GPN, we should call it a convention on certain computer topics or something, just in the vein of this. And there will be others, I suppose, because as time went on, laws change, circumstances change, and so we must take care of that. So, first of all, where am I? My slides got mixed. So let's take a look at the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions are a set of three conventions. And they also have, if you read the conventions, you have, for starters, you have some general parts. Then you have the more specific part where all text is in that the convention's about, and then you have the closing. And the general provisions are for all three treaties the same. First of all, they have this clause that says you have to pay respect to the convention because this laws should be something special. And so, yeah, you have to show respect to the convention because... then you have the application of the convention where we just basically define what's the use and where do we use it, EA conflicts between two high contracting parties. Then we have, this is a big one. Article 3 is mostly between conflicts between not internal conflicts, because at some point they said, well, there's not really a distinction between external and internal conflicts, but also the states are sovereign, so we cannot dictate what they should do. And that is the try to negate that a bit. To say, hey, you can sign this and then maybe treat your citizen as not as bad as you maybe do. Then the field of application, what's the treaty all about? How in what field of theater does it apply? Application by neutral powers, can other parties use the treaty as well? Special agreements, if you are two parties, you can... you are allowed to do treaties between you if you have a conflict. No one stops you. You cannot revoke the Geneva Conventions. When you signed it and ratified it, you have to follow them. Protecting powers defines just if you have two parties in a conflict, you want like a third party that takes a look at things and is a neutral party where both parties agree to. If the party says you do something wrong, then the party's neutral, so you respect that, and then the legal actions can go forth from that. Then they define the activities of the ICRC, also the International Committee of the Red Cross, what they do and what they should do, like care for all that injured people and the citizens and that. Substitutes for protecting powers, they define that, well, sometimes if you have a protecting power and the protecting power turns out to be not protecting at all or a little bit bogus, there are rules in place where you can say, give me another protecting power, switch them around. And cancellation of procedure, do I have something to that? No, I don't know. then there are the endings. The ending is just bureaucracy. Maybe the ending of the Geneva Conventions just say, hey, the texts are originally in English and French. So that are the languages that are the treaties are written in. That are the languages you should use because they are the most precise. If you have a translation, then it might be get a little bit rough around the edges. There are translations, and there are I think a few articles concerning translations as well. Also, there are the signatures. Every party following the Geneva Conventions has to sign them. Then they have to ratify them. The ratification is stored in Bern. Then we have a clause coming into force that basically says, hey, as long as two parties are ratified, you have 6 weeks, and then the Geneva Convention, the specific Geneva Convention, is in order. And accession is who can be a third, a higher contracting party, who can join or follow the Geneva Convention. Basically said every higher contracting party, nation state, can be joined the Geneva Convention. Also, there are in some cases are they sign it, they ratify it, but they are not quite content with the what the convention says, so they wrote their own comment, and yeah, that might be interesting later on. So we let's start with the first Geneva Convention, the Geneva Convention for amelioration of the condition of the wounded and armies on the field. That was the first one to be created the first one who started this was Henry Durand, who saw the aftermath of the Battle of Solferino, and what he saw was so horrific that he said, "No, there must be something we can do." And out of that, he was then one of the creators of the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Geneva Convention, just because the battle was so horrific. They are free. And mostly the Geneva Conventions are about protecting people and places, weapon, total other text and treaty. So the first Geneva Convention, the original one, had just a few basic points. First of all, how you treated or what do you do with captured and who can you capture? And so if you are out of battle, if you are wounded or you're a civilian, then that's maybe not, yeah, you should be cared for, no? And the treatment you receive is impartial, means that no matter on which side you're on, you get treated because you're wounded and you need help. Also, the civilians and the medical personnel, you don't tell them ever, because they treat your soldiers if they're wounded. And in the original text, at least, the Red Cross is a protective symbol. Means you paint it on a building where your wounded are treated. And that's a no-go. You don't attack that building because it wears this protective symbol. There are other symbols that will come in reminded for later. Also, the Red Cross is... you should only use this as protected symbol. The Red Cross is a trademark of the International Committee of the Red Cross. So in daily life, you should not use it because copyright protection, and also because it's a protective symbol and you just want to use it in that specific purpose because this is the meaning and should not be a daily use because it's something special. It protects those who need it. Then they amended it later revisions. Some articles dealing about the sick and the evacuation of the sick and wounded, which evacuations you can do, which you can do not. Then you have retained personnel. If your personal medical personnel gets captured, they usually have to be returned to their country and their side of the conflict, except veterinarians, they're out of luck. In the sources of my talk, there is an other talk linked, a video from an US Army I don't know what his rank is, who talks about this stuff for medic personnel is quite interesting, and it goes a little bit deeper because they also talk about if you're medical personnel, you're not allowed to attack or wear weapons, and what is if you get captured and you cannot go back to your site, can you flee, what do you do? It's quite interesting, but it would be too long to mention it all here, so if you're interested, look at the source. I load up the slides later. Also, one topic is recording and forwarding information. You have to establish means of get information and recordings of your captured, of your wounded person back and forth to conflict, so they can, oh, he's missing, maybe we should do something about it. And then prescriptions regarding that, the dead should not be cremated, and they should be probably ID'd. And there's more, but I have to paint relatively broad strokes because the talk gets longer and longer and more complicated. We have a few conventions to wade through. At the end of every convention I talk about, there will be grave breaches. Grave breaches are the slightly beautiful term for of the Geneva Convention for war crimes. And I think that's important enough that I quote the full thing here. Should I read it? Grave breaches to which the preceding article relates shall be those involving any of the following acts if committed against persons or property protected by the convention: willful killing, torture or inhuman treatment, including biological experience, willful causing great suffering or serious injury to body and health, and extensive destruction and appropriation of property not justified by military necessity and carried out unlawful and wantonly. If that happens, that as far as I could find out, the procedure goes as follows. If one side thinks that a great breach happened, they inform the protective powers, and the protective power then launch an investigation, and if they come to the conclusion it has happened, then they round up the suspects, meaning the people who committed them and who commanded them, and they can then bring them to trial in their own under their own laws, or they can commit them to a court of another high contracting party, which might be the case of attrition in the Hague. That's how what I read, but I'm not quite sure if that's 200% accurate, so you take it with a grain of salt. The second Geneva Convention is something like, came next to the first, is a little bit like the ready meal of Geneva Conventions because, you know, just at water. It's all about marine warfare, and it's basically the same, to some extent, of the first one, just for marine forces. All parties must protect and care for wounded, sick, and water, shipwrecked. We care for the wounded, shipwrecked. It's the body of water, so we need maybe need neutral vessels because we have not enough capacity or tonnage to get all who swim there in the water after our attack to safety. So we can ask neutral vessels if they want to or if they pick up the shipwrecked. And maybe it's a good thing if we don't attack the neutral vessels. I mean, come on. And the religious and medical personnel, as said with return, as a medical personnel always has a protective status, so we cannot, attack them or take them captured, but we can capture the wounded and sick on the ship. That's a little bit of a bad idea, as we see in the next Geneva Convention, or so I think. Also, Article 51, grave breaches of the second Geneva Convention. As far as I just flipped through both tabs of my browser, and they seem identical with the first one, so I will not read the whole thing again. The third Geneva Convention, time marches on. We see that we have the medical personnel, and we treated the wounded and sick, and then suddenly we come to the conclusion, maybe we have prisoners of war, how we treat them. What are prisoners of war? Who can have the protective status of a prisoner of war? Armed forces and militias, and volunteer corps, including organized resistance movements. Ha! What do they need to get this protected status? They need a person who's responsible, a commander of some sorts. They must have, as all military forces, a distinctive sign. If you are in a conflict, you must wear a distinctive sign. Otherwise, you violate the Geneva Convention. You must carry your arms openly. And of course, you must follow the laws of the Geneva Convention and the international humanitarian law, because, yeah. Prisoners of war can also be civil personnel who have support roles in the army, merchant and marine crews of civil aircraft and ships, and inhabitants of non-occupied territory who spontaneously take up arms, because, yeah, they take our land. We just not sit idle by. Yeah, you're protected. The POW are protected from the time captured till they are till the conflict's over. When you are in doubt if someone is a POW or not, then he is a POW until the tribunal can settle the matter. So, protected. Also, your retained medical personnel and your chaplains take precedence over all other POWs in treatment. That's that. Next step. The POVs are responsibility of the state, not the person who captures them. They can be not transferred to a state that's outside of the convention. It's not a party of the convention. They can only transport to high contracting parties. They must be treated humanely, and their medical need must be met. If you remember the slides to 3 minutes ago about ships and that you can capture the wounded and sick on that ship, why would you do that? You have to care for them, you must treat them humanely. If they're already on a vessel that helps them, let them. What says the Geneva Convention about captivity? Don't mind a bracket, that slips through. What information must you give? Some bad action movie might already mention that. Maybe you know that. Surname, first names, rank, date of birth, and army, regimental, personnel, or serial number. You can now use physical or mental torture, not prohibited. They have to allow external relations. You have let them send and receive posts, and their family can talk to them. Also, there are also regulations what private property can a POV keep. A POV must evacuate it from the combat zone as soon as possible. And then they regulate all matters of things that occur during internment, like what quality of quarters do we have, food, clothing, they must provide hygiene and medical attention. The medical personnel and chaplains, how are they treated? As I said, they must be returned as soon as possible to their side of the party. Religious practice has to be allowed, and intellectual and physical activities must be provided. If you provide physical activities, discipline and military rank must also provide. If you provide intellectual and physical activities, they also regulate what kind of work you can force. Or what kind of work POW can do, and can they be paid, or what are their monetary rules in the POW camp? Also, there are relations of POWs with the exterior world. As said, post is allowed. If the post gets censored, they must be censored quickly. And also, you have to establish something like a committee of PO, the committee might be the wrong word, but an interface between the POWs and the power that captures them, so that disputes can be talked about, like or accommodations are wet and not hygienic enough, and maybe please give us more food, or everything that creates friction and has to be solved can be unsolved to this committee. The rest of the Geneva Convention talks about the termination of captivity, when are the prisoners released, EA.
when is the conflict over if he's too sick and must be transferred elsewhere, etc. There is the Information and Relief Society for POWs that takes care of all, a few external things like help and care packages and so on. And the execution of the convention, that's a leftover from my creating process of the slide. The execution of the convention, you remember the first series about the ending of all conventions. That's the execution is part of that. The third grave breaches is more or less the same as the first two, except that they also mentioning that you cannot, serve in the forces of a hostile power, willfully depriving a prisoner of war of the rights of a fair and regular trial described in the conventions. Basically, it's the stuff from the first one, four POWs plus some extra rules. The fourth one, just a step further. Now we don't have POWs, but we take a look at generally the civil population of a conflict. part two is about what means do we have to protect the civilian population of a conflict. We have hospitals, which we learned have this protection sign. If we are so inclined, the high contracting parties in the conflict can say, yeah, we both recognize certain neutralized zones where we don't attack. Generally, the wounded and sick are protected, meaning you don't shell them, you don't shell the transports, the first aid vents, etc. It should be possibly that you can evacuate the sick if they need to be evacuated. As I said, hospitals are protected. Hospital staff has to wear ID cards and can be identified so that you don't shell them. You have to let medical supplies through. There are a few exceptions if you are suspicious that they don't arrive at where they are needed. But in general, you must let them through. They are protected. The hospital staff is protected. There are rules for land, sea, and air transport. You don't attack land and sea transport. Also, air transports have to fly in a certain corridor, meaning at a certain height, at a certain route, and are also off limits for attacks. I mentioned it. Foot and clothing and medical supplies should be let through. There are measures regarding child welfare. Thank you very much. If you have orphans or childs who don't know where their families are, you have to care for them. You must at least attempt to try to find their family. You have to let personal letters through and family news through so that people can inform themselves where their relatives are and how they are doing. And dispersed families is the same as childcare, I think. Next part is persons. That's a neat one. Prohibition of corporal punishment. If someone does something wrong, say you have occupied an area, you cannot just stand to PD punish all people are there just because they're there and they look suspicious. Just the person who really, really did the thing, you have a punishment. Corporal punishment for short. Everyone is individual responsibility for her actions, and only individuals can be punished. And to a certain degree, you cannot torture them, for example. And pillage and our reprisals are also be forbidden. There are articles about transfers and evacuation. You cannot just because you want just deport all of the inhabitants of an occupied zone, and you cannot deport, say, parts of your populace into the occupied zone.
Genau, also unnecessary destruction of enemy property is also forbidden, and you must take care of children. Yeah, property destruction is forbidden, and you must take care that the basic necessities of the daily life are met. So you must provide something like, you know, a little bit of electricity and water and so on and so forth. You can internment people, but they have a right to a fair trial and the right to appeal. These are the great breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Time is a little bit short, so I will skip them. I just leave it up for a moment. Maybe the it mentions the it mentions the regular trial and willfully depriving a protected person of rights of fair and regulated trial, taking hostages, extensive destruction and appropriation of property, maybe just all things I talked about earlier. The Geneva Conventions, as you heard so far, are all of protecting people. Now the fun part begins now. We talk a little bit about weaponry and why we not use them. The first treaty that has that as a topic was the Hague Convention in 1899, proposed for by Tsar Nicholas III, the second, and influenced by the Lieber Code. That's an code that, or a law regarding weaponry and so forth, that was signed during the American Civil War by Lincoln. They have such topics like the settlement of international disputes, then the laws and customs of war and land. I mentioned certain things that are not concerning weapons at all, but they are in the treaty, so I mentioned them. We also take a look at marine warfare because, 1899 flying was a little bit off by then. Except balloons. you find a, they were afraid you drop something from a balloon, but they barred it for 5 years. You couldn't use bombs for 5 years by dropping them by balloon. After that, that's off. You cannot use projectiles with the sole object of spread asphyxiating poisonous gases. There is later on there is an protocol to the convention that goes in a little bit deeper, and we can not use soft bullets or bullet that expands, meaning a dumb weaponry. That was the first Hague Convention. The second was initiated by Theodore Roosevelt because the Russian and the Japanese were at war, and so let us talk about it a little bit further. I cut the topics a little bit down because not all, it was mostly topics from the first slide. So they took a look at conversion of merchant ships into warships. Laying of automatic submarine contact mines was a thing back then that they had to talk about. bombardments and a lot of maritime stuff. Also, they established the International Prize Court, and also balloons was still a thing. Those are just the basics. The convention on certain conventional weapons is much deeper, as mentioned earlier, but I wouldn't want to bore you with that, so if you want to look it up. In the sources, there are the International Red Cross has a database of all treaties and texts concerning the international humanitarian law, where you can find all that thing, also the commentaries. Have fun. It's worth reading. There is the Geneva the so-called Geneva Protocol, which talks a little bit about not using poisonous gases and bacteriological warfare. Some person took a look in 2002, as I recall. When you read the title, it's all fine, and then you start to think for a moment, and it has a little bit of a shortcoming. They not prohibit the use against not ratifying parties, which a bad thing, not the nicest thing you can do. It's not prohibited to use them as retaliation, so as long as you don't fire first, you are fine. And research on those weapons also not prohibited, and so you can say, I'm just researching and stockpile them. That's, yeah, it's a first good step, but it's maybe not the end. You should work on that. Also, who signed? Many nations signed. All have, some of them has a reservation, and the list is quite long, meaning, so yeah, we signed, but we not respect all of it, and that's also a bad thing in my book. Next is, also, that thing is called, at least to the Wikipedia article, the Geneva Protocol. There are three Geneva Protocols, and I really, really can't tell you what's the difference between the Geneva Protocol and the Geneva Protocols. So if someone finds that out, tell me. I'm really eager to know. The first Geneva Protocol is an extension to the Geneva Conventions, and it also extends on the Geneva Conventions and adds additional rules. Some of them, it has 102 articles. I just skimmed through some here. Perfidy is prohibited. Pilots who are jump out of their aircraft because they're in distress, don't fire on them. The compliance, they clarify the identification of armed forces. I just want to mention a merchant shall not have the right to be in combatant or prisoner of war, so they are not protected. They outlaw and discriminate attacks on civilian population, destruction of food and water. As mentioned, as the from the other protocol, you have to care for the populace and must provide with basic needs, so this is more or less a recap. You cannot attack infrastructure, dams, power plants, water treatment facilities. No go. Women, children, medical personnel, are special protectors, also journalists, just saying. You cannot conscribe children under age of 15, except if they do it voluntarily. Also, they clarify the status of guerrilla forces. They can be protected under the Geneva Convention. Same points as before, if they have a commander where their identification, then they are fine. It's a crime to use the protective emblems of the deceiving. You cannot hide yourself behind an protective emblem and then attack. No, protect. This is a protective emblem. It's for protective purposes only. You don't misuse them. The second protocol is, I mentioned Article 3 of the Geneva Convention before. Article 3 is the article you have at the beginning that gives people in internal conflicts of nations some certain rights. Basically, the protocol, Geneva Protocol 2, is the same thing as the protection of civilians. Where am I? just a moment. So it's just basically the same as the Geneva Protocol for civilians in international conflicts, just for internal conflicts. Might be an interesting talk just about that protocol and see what actually is used in the world out there. The third Geneva Protocol concerns the protective sign. You have a few organizations that are protected, but regarding to culture and customs, they all have different emblems, and some of them wanted protection, but they were hesitant to allow the symbol of the organization as protective sign. for example, Megan David Adam used the Red Star of David, and for some reason the International Red Cross said, no, this, we cannot allow it, or we don't want to use that as a protective sign, so they came up with the Red Crystal. The Red Crystal is, see here, is a neutral sign, and so you can use this for your organization. I think they allow that you have your own emblem in the middle, and yeah, so bit of a development there. So if you see this sign, it's the same as the Red Cross when it comes to protection. Don't shoot at it. Don't shoot at buildings that carry that sign. That's important. Last one. There is the Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property. And I took that into the slides because it's a little bit underrepresented. There are cultural, say, statues and other museums that normally are or were not protected. If you see one of those, not all three, then you cannot shoot at them because they are culturally important for all of us. If you see three of them, they have some special statuses, and the government on which land this thing stands has to take certain measures to make sure that they are a little bit better protected. Also, don't shoot on them. I just want to bring it up because we always talk about civilians and POWs, but also, hey, we have a culture and maybe we should protect them as well. So that was it for the talk. I hope I bored you not to death, and I hope it was somewhat coherent what I talked about. Thank you for listening. If there are any questions, please.
Yes.
You talked about the Red Cross and the other protective symbol. Is there any pre-established process to validate if someone is using them in good faith?
I didn't understand the last bit of the sentence. Sorry.
Someone could just put up the Red Cross on military.
Yeah, I mentioned this. Let me show. It's a war crime to use one of the protective emblems to deceive the opposing forces.
That would be in a trial after the conflict.
Yeah, that is what I mentioned. If that happens, the high contracting party, goddammit, must go to the protective power and say, hey, we think there has happened something. Let's take a look, and then the legal process starts. As far as I know.
Okay. More questions?
Why would you need a special protocol for inner conflicts? I mean,
because they in the beginning they only had for some reasons they didn't care about the inner conflicts, because the inner conflicts, a country is sovereign, so you cannot take an international organization or an outside party and dictate dictate laws that the country should follow. That's their stuff. They are the country. Yeah. Between two countries it's possible because they can get talks going, and yeah, you know, you give me that, I give you that. But internally, they can't. But they thought that they. From the eyes of the affected, it's the same. So they made the Article 3 and the Protocol number, what was it, 2, to reconcile that. I hope I answered your question somewhat.
But is it different from the, does it have different rules?
No, but it's a different namespace, I would think, okay. If that makes sense. Or a little bit legalese namespace, you know.
More questions?
Who is responsible for enforcement of those rules?
The protective powers. As far as I read up, I have the same question, but I couldn't find out. The Geneva Convention always talks about in terms of protective powers. Everything that happens happens through the protective power. The protective power is there for the special purpose to take a look, to play the referee in this conflict.
If someone knows more, please make a talk. I'm eager to find out as well. I didn't understand you, sorry, there's the mic.
Usually you call the United Nations for support and the Security Council for a referendum and they concern to engage because there are rules of engagement for intervene or not intervene. It's a little bit complex situation.
In the end, it boils down that they play the part of the protective power, if I'm right.
Mostly.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
More questions?
I don't think so. So thank you again for this talk. I hope everybody learned something. I doubt that a lot of people actually have
just
answers.
So that people see, these are the sources. If you have the PDF, these are the links to the databases, and the thing at the bottom is the video from the US military talk about the retained personnel and what to do if you ever in this situation. Yeah.
Thank you, Blickfeld Kurier.
Thank you.